the pricing game at the start of this class. And this is a real pricing game. It's kind of fun to watch from the outside. Actually see the process play out. Demand, supply, momentum, mood. And then, of course, after the fact, people make up fundamental or intrinsic value stories for why they're doing what they're doing, and it's nothing to do with what's happening. So let's keep our eyes on it, because it'll be like a lab experiment that goes through the entire class. Let's see what it does over the rest of the semester. So let me start off again with our usual start of the class test. I'm going to go back and kind of talk a little bit about what I ended the last class with, which is regression betas don't work. Or at least one regression beta. Using one regression beta to get the beta for your company doesn't work. And we talked about a process of estimating a beta by looking at the business or businesses we're in. So we're going to talk about that today. But before we get into the process of estimating bottom-up betas and the intuition and the logic and why we do it, let me ask you some very pragmatic questions. And for those of you who were in my corporate finance class, you had to struggle with these questions, you know. But this is a question you're going to face when we decide that we're going to estimate a beta by looking at companies within the business the company is in. So here's my question for you. If you buy into my notion that bottom-up betas are better than a single regression beta, then you need a group of companies to get a beta from, right? So I'm going to give you some choices about which, and I'd like you to tell me which one of these would be the best way to get a bottom-up beta for your company. One is a small sample of companies that are very much like yours. In what dimensions? You can define the criteria in terms of market cap, the market you're listed in, what it does. So essentially how old it is. You can add as many criteria as you want, but you can go for a small sample of companies very much like yours. Your second sample is a large sample of companies, but there you've got to give on some dimension. You might have smaller companies, riskier companies, companies in other markets. So the second is a large sample where you're willing to kind of let companies be different. And the third is maybe you can find one company just like yours. So how would this work out? For a long time, GM and Ford were kind of twinned at the hip. So if you want to look at GM, you looked at Ford. Ford, you looked at GM. So one company just like yours, or very similar to you, a small sample of companies which are, for the most part, similar, or a large sample. If you're doing a bottom-up beta, which one would you go for? Let me jump the gun. Why do we not like regression betas? Because there's a lot of noise in them, right? Standard error. So why do we use bottom-up betas? Because when you average out, you get a more precise number. But what's the law that backs up that averaging notion? It's a law of large numbers, right? And what do you need for the law of large numbers? You need large numbers. That kind of answers the question, right? In other words, you go with one company, all you've done is replace one regression beta with another, nothing gained. The really small sample might be companies just like yours, but you're missing the big advantage of a bottom-up beta, which is the averaging benefit. So this is something you're going to have to face. When you're doing a Brazilian aerospace company, do you want to limit your sample to other Brazilian aerospace companies, in which case you're doomed? And we're going to talk about Embraer today. Or do you want to go to emerging market aerospace companies? Do you want to go global? This is something that we have the luxury of picking now. So if you have access to Capital IQ, and I sent you that, and you might still have a little time left. So if you haven't registered for Capital IQ, please do. Because it's an insanely powerful way of getting large samples in no time at all. Right? This is something we'll have to face. So we'll come back and talk about this. Second, the notion of a comparable, I think, has been hijacked over the last 4 or 5 decades. So if you go into an investment bank or an equity research analyst and you look at a software company and they show you comparable companies, they have already a predetermined notion of what's comparable, right? So I'm going to go through a list of what you might look for in a comparable, and you tell me whether this is something you will look for, at least for a beta. So this is not about pricing, this is about beta. You want a company in the same industry group? It's a first. Do you? Does a comparable company have to be in the same industry group as your company? Maybe not, right? Because what are we trying to measure? Exposure to macroeconomic risk. So if you're a consulting firm and you get all your business from banks, let's say you consult to banks, You might be a consulting firm, but the beta for your company has nothing to do with consulting firms. It's really the beta of banks. So there's nothing in the process that requires you to stay within the group that your company is categorized in. It doesn't have to be listed on the same market. In fact, this is a trick we're going to use repeatedly with emerging market companies, because if I stay focused within the market that I'm in, I'm going to get really small samples in most markets, right? So I'm looking at an Indonesian steel company, and I say I look at only other Indonesian steel companies, I have a really small sample. So I'm going to feel this urge to go global. And when I do that, people are going to complain, but it's an Indonesian company, so what's the undercurrent there? It's a risky company. You can't use the beta from a German steel manufacturer. What should the response to that be? It is true, Indonesian companies are riskier, right? But is beta the device which I'm going to use to carry that risk? What's the other component in my cost of equity that carries that risk? I have my equity risk premium. That's what's designed to carry country risk. A beta is not designed to carry country risk. If anybody tells you different, they're misunderstanding what betas are scaled around. What's the average beta across all Indonesian companies? It's one. The average beta across all U.S. companies is one. Because betas are scaled around one, you can't have betas carry the weight of companies being developed or emerging market companies. Do companies have to be of the same market cap? We're going to come back and talk about this, because in valuation, there is this practice of adding what's called a small cap premium. What that often is to come up with the cost of equity for a small company. Here's what you do. You take the risk-free rate. You take a beta times an equity risk premium. So far we're on solid ground. And then they'll add another 4 or 5% to the cost of equity. And you ask them, what are you doing? They say, I'm adding a small cap premium. The argument being, small companies are riskier than larger companies, and therefore they should have a higher cost of equity. The logic looks impeccable, right? It is true smaller companies are riskier than larger companies. But what's the follow-up question we need to ask before you adjust the cost of equity for it? What kind of risk do we build into the cost of equity? Risk that you cannot diversify away, right? So if you're going to give me an argument about small companies being riskier than large companies, I get it. But if that risk is survival risk or risk that is not macroeconomic driven, then it shouldn't be in the cost of equity. So we're going to come back and talk about whether we should be adjusting for it. But again, it's a practice that you see in bankers and analysts use, is to look at companies in the same market, in the same sector, often with similar market cap. And none of those are prerequisites for what should be into a comparable company, at least from a beta standpoint. We're also going to talk about debt and its cost today. Okay? And this is, I think, an item that gets screwed up a lot in cost of capital calculation. So I'm going to give you a very simple example. And I'd like you to tell me what I should be using as a cost of debt here. So I'm trying to estimate a cost of capital for a firm. The firm has $1 billion in bank loans outstanding. Keyword is bank loan. So what am I already telling you? There is no traded price. I can't look up the yield to maturity. I'm taking away all the easy ways you have of estimating cost of debt, right? You can't look up a rating. There's nothing there. Right? So the interest rate on those loans was, so when you borrowed the money, the interest rate was set at 4%. There's a remaining maturity of 8 years. The current risk-free rate is 5%. And you believe, based on your assessment of the company, that given the riskiness of the company, they're going to be paying a 2% default spread over the risk-free rate. So I have a very simple question. It's a question that goes to the heart of what a cost of debt should be in a cost of capital. I'm going to give you some choices on the cost of debt. You tell me whether you'd use this as your cost of debt and your cost of capital, and if you will not, tell me how you justify not using it. The first number is the 4%. You see where the 4% comes from? That's actually the interest rate on your bank loan. Can I use that as my pre-tax cost of debt? You know, about 60% of cost of capital calculations, that's what gets used as the pre-tax cost of debt. So give me your rationale. So I'm your managing director and say, this is what I've always done. I've always, tell me why, in a very polite way, because I'm your managing director, why I shouldn't be doing this. There's actually a very simple, logical explanation you can give for why 4% doesn't work as a pre-tax cost of debt here. What's your risk-free rate? 5%. So if I use a pre-tax cost of debt of 4%, I'm assuming you can borrow money today at a rate less than the risk-free rate. That's not going to happen. So the 4% is a historical interest rate. It's the rate at which you borrowed money at. But the cost of debt and the cost of capital is the rate at which you can borrow money long term today. That's critical. Not the rate at which you borrowed money yesterday, 5 years ago. The company will always, but I could get back as a debt. But that's the rate I have. It's irrelevant what rate I have in my loan because I have to make more than what I can make elsewhere in the market today. So the 4% is off the table because it is a historical cost. The 5% is neither here nor there. It's a risk-free rate. So unless you're the government, why does it even come into play? The 7% is, of course, the 5 plus the 2%, which is the default spread added to the risk-free rate. The 5.5% of people who have no idea what to do, they just split the difference. I just took the 4 and the 7, added the 2 up, divided by 2. Right? So let's rule that out. That's actually worse than using any other number. If you're going to screw up, at least pick one number to screw up with, stay with it. Don't average screw up, because actually it might be a worse screw up than just screwing up with one number and doing it consistently. So the cost of debt pre-tax is 7%. Now you see what that tells you? The cost of debt is a number that changes every minute of every day. But before you freak out, remember the cost of equity also changes every minute of every day. Your cost of capital as a company changes every minute of every day. You don't like it, don't run a business. You're in a macro environment where everything changes. You have to accept. And if you're an emerging market, an investment that looked good at 9:30 in the morning could look awful by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Nothing you can do about it. So in a sense, that's the reality we have to bring into the cost of debt. One final point, and this is not actually on your slide, but when we do cost of capital weights, they're supposed to be market value weights. Right? Remember the previous problem I gave you, the $1 billion in bank loans outstanding, and I told you the interest rate on the loan was 4%? Let's suppose I told you that this company has $1 billion in equity, market value, and I wanted a market debt to capital ratio to use in my cost of capital. Just give me a sense of direction as to what that debt ratio is going to look like. First, will it be 50%? Looks like the bank loan is $1 billion, right? Equity is $1 billion. So why isn't it 50%? What's $1 billion that I gave you as the bank loan? That's the book value of the debt, right? What's the interest rate on the debt? 4%. What's the market interest rate today on that same debt? It's 7%. Remember how to price a bond? If I gave you a bond with a coupon rate of 4%, the interest rate on that bond is 7% today. What will happen to the market price of the bond? You got a 50-50 shot. Will it be less than par or more than par? Come on, give it a 50-50 shot. It'll be less. There'll be a discount on the bond. The only condition under which the book value and market value will be the same is the book interest rate is equal to the market interest rate. So if you computed the debt ratio for this company, it's actually going to be less than 50%, because even though on the face of it, it looks like they're the same, because that debt is old debt and market interest rates have gone up, the market value of the debt has come down. So the 2 points I want you to remember about debt. One is the cost of debt is an ever-shifting number, should reflect the rate at which you can borrow money long-term today. The second is we want market value numbers, not book value numbers. And the fact that something is not traded, as was the case here, doesn't mean you cannot estimate the market value for that debt. Any questions on those basics? Okay, so let's go back to the... I think we're on page 80 of the notes, so let me... Okay, so last session I ended with this talk about, so I made the case, I think, that regression beta, a single regression beta is a dangerous number to base a valuation on for 3 reasons. One is it's backward looking. The second is it's one slice of history and the slope you get comes with a standard error and a lot of noise. And the third is if this is the only way you can estimate a beta, you're stuck with private businesses or divisions of companies. So I suggested that one way to get around the problem is to estimate a bottom-up beta. To lay the foundation for this, I'm going to revisit something we talked about in corporate finance and review it very quickly. When you look at the beta for a company, it does not come from a regression. It's not a statistical number. It's an economic number. And there are three decisions, and only three, that you make as a company that determine that beta. So as we list these, start thinking about any company you want. Maybe the company you were supposed to have picked for your project. Think about that company and start thinking about what the beta should look like. The first is, what type of business are you in? And here's the rationale. The more discretionary the product or service you provide as a company, the higher your beta will be as a company. See what I mean by more discretionary? Basically, if your customers can live without this product, they can delay buying it, they can defer buying it, you will have a higher beta than if they cannot do that. So luxury retailers should have a higher beta than a department store, and a department store should have a higher beta than a discount retailer. So that's the first factor. What business are you in? What are the products or services you provide? Second, what kind of fixed cost do you have as a company? The greater the fixed cost you have as a company, it's called operating leverage, the higher your beta will be as a company. Think of why. When you have a lot of fixed costs, in good times you make lots of money, in bad times you lose lots of money. Everything gets magnified. So sectors which have high fixed costs, like the airlines, infrastructure companies, should have higher betas than companies which don't have as much in fixed costs. So what kind of business are you in? What's your cost structure look like? Third, how much have you borrowed? And the reason that affects your beta is when you borrow money, you create a fixed cost you did not have until you borrowed the money, right? Which is interest expenses. You got to make those interest expenses in good times, which is not a big deal. But you also have to make the interest expense in bad times, which makes your equity earnings much more volatile. So think about that. When you think about a beta, rather than thinking about what kind of regression should I run, go back to basics. What business am I in? What kind of products or services do I provide? What's the cost structure look like for this company? How much has it borrowed? Because by the time you finish answering those three questions, you should at least have a basis for thinking about whether your company should have a high beta, an average beta, or a low beta. In fact, in the context of debt, we know exactly how it plays out on the beta because we have a very simple equation we can use to estimate the levered beta for a company. It's a beta of the business you're in, which comes from the discretionary and the fixed cost components, times 1 plus 1 minus the tax rate, because debt does give you that tax advantage, times whatever your debt-to-equity ratio is. As you borrow money, as the debt-to-equity ratio goes up, your levered or equity beta will go up. So let's use that to kind of set up a three-step process by which we can think about betas. So in a perfect world, here's how you'd estimate the beta for a company. You'd start with the beta of the pure business you're in. What kind of discretionary or non-discretionary product or service would start with that? It's almost a macroeconomic judgment you make. Second step, you layer on the fixed cost structure of this company. So in other words, you'll take the business beta for the company, and if it happens to have a lot of fixed costs, you'll push it up even more. So there's a business beta, there's an operating leverage effect, and finally you bring in the financial leverage effect. So in a perfect world, that's the three-step process you'd follow to estimating betas. We don't quite live in that perfect world, and here's why. To do the second step, here's what you need. You need the breakdown of fixed and variable costs of every company in your sector. Now imagine opening up the financial statements for every company. What are you checking for? Which costs are fixed, which are variable, right? You look at an accounting statement, here's what you're going to see. You're going to see revenues at the top. Then you're going to see cost of goods sold, but it's not broken down into fixed and variable. You can try to make judgments about what's fixed and what's variable. So when you look at the cost breakdown for most companies, you don't get a breakdown of fixed and variable costs. So the problem with that second step is adjusting for operating leverage becomes difficult, not because we don't know how to do it. We know exactly how to do it. And what we need is the fixed and the variable cost for every company. And if you gave me that breakdown, I can actually tell you how much the beta for Southwest Airlines should be relative to other airlines because it is a lower operating leverage. But to do it, you need the fixed and variable cost by company. I'll make a confession. I almost never adjust for operating leverage. So when I look at a steel company, I use the beta for other steel companies. Chemical company, beta for other chemical companies. Implicitly, what am I assuming? That all steel companies have roughly the same cost structure. Is that appropriate? It probably isn't. But I really don't have much choice at the moment. Maybe there will be a time where the data, so when you go into capital IQ, it allows you to get fixed and variable costs as separate line items. And the minute that is available, I should be able to adjust for differences in operating leverage across companies. In fact, if you look at the equation for adjusting for operating leverage, it looks very much like the equation for adjusting for financial leverage, right? Where you replace debt with fixed costs an equity variable cost and you effectively get the same equation. The reason you don't have a 1 minus T is both costs are tax deductible, so you don't have a differential tax benefit, but it looks very much like the financial leverage adjustment. So that's the operating leverage effect, and if anybody asks you, why don't we adjust for fixed costs and variable costs, throw it back into their, into them. Say, okay, fine, I'm willing to adjust for it, just tell me the breakdown of fixed and variable costs for every company in the sector. It's an information problem, not an analytical problem. Any questions on operating leverage? Yes?
Can you just look back historically at how you get changes going?
You could. In fact, we did that in corporate finance. The only problem is it's a pretty noisy number. So if you do that for individual companies, first you need a lot of history, right? So if you're looking at companies where, so if you're looking at a sector where every company's been around 40 or 50 years and hasn't changed very much because that's the other underlying assumption, you could look at historical data. But if either of those assumptions breaks down, then in a sense it's tough to do. Okay? I'll tell you, I said I almost never do. I'll tell you when I do make a little adjustment for operating leverage. If you ask me to value Southwest Airlines, those outlier companies where we know that the company does things differently to make its cost structure more flexible, then I might use a lower beta than the beta for the sector, and the adjustment is often a little arbitrary because I really have no easy way. I'll tell you what might change that. If we get enough discount airlines out there which share Southwest characteristics and you're able to compare them to the other airlines, maybe we can start dividing companies up on that basis as well. But we need some way of measuring flexible cost structure that doesn't require a lot of history, because then we can start doing this adjustment. Yes, Tobias?
So you need to unlever the beta for variable.
Yeah, this is a pure unlevered beta process. So what we're doing is we're taking those unlevered betas by sectors and we're breaking them down even further into unlevered beta of being in the retail business plus an operating leverage effect. So in a sense, it's almost a second breakdown. You go from levered to unlevered beta for the business to unlevered beta for the pure business and an operating leverage effect. Okay. Any other questions? Now let's talk about adjusting for financial leverage. The conventional approach, again, wherever there's a question mark, remember there's supposed to be a Greek alphabet in there, so it should be okay in your notes. The conventional approach that I kind of put out during the corporate finance class is called the Hamada adjustment for betas. And basically, it's a levered beta for a company. It's the unlevered beta times 1 plus 1 minus the tax rate times the debt-to-equity ratio. This actually traces its origins back to a very famous paper in corporate finance by Merton Miller and Franco Modigliani. The Miller-Modigliani theorem, remember? Basically, the Miller-Modigliani theorem, the first paper showed that debt did not matter, that debt was irrelevant. The second paper actually brought in the tax benefits of debt without any bankruptcy costs and showed that in those circumstances, what do companies do? If I give them tax benefits and don't have to worry about bankruptcy costs, how much should I borrow? Basically, I'm going to borrow everything. So this is Miller-Modigliani too. So it's a very simplistic view of the world where the tax benefits of debt get counted. So this equation for the unlevered beta is built on that old Miller-Modigliani equation, which is a bit of a problem because we're using it in a cost-to-capital computation where we are allowing for bankruptcy costs. So is there a logical problem there? Sure. In fact, the fuller version of this levered beta equation does allow for the fact that some of the market risk in a company is borne by the lenders. Okay? In the first equation, all of the market risk is borne by the equity investors. There is no market risk in debt. In the second approach, we're allowing for the fact that there might be some market risk in debt. Let's get pragmatic here. When you look at junk bonds, right? High-yield bonds, and you look at what causes their prices to move, often they move a lot like equity. In other words, good things happen to the company, junk bonds, prices go up. So there is empirical evidence that once you get below, let's say, triple B, double B, single B, the lower ratings, that bonds start to behave more like equity. Know what I'm saying? That basically means that the beta for low-grade bonds is not zero, which is what we're assuming in the first approach. It could be a number higher than zero. How much higher? It depends on how junk your junk is, right? Because the closer you get to the bottom, the more you behave like equity. And the minute you allow for the fact that debt has market risk, then you open the door to estimating a beta for debt. And if you can estimate a beta for debt, then the levered beta for equity has to reflect the fact that some of the market risk is being borne by the lender. So let's play a game. Let's suppose your equity investors in a company, your lenders in the company. In the initial world, I'm assuming that you bear all the market risk. So your levered beta has to capture all of the market risk. That's the original equation. Now I say, you know what? You can suck these guys into the process. They're going to bear some of your market risk. So you're going to funnel off some of the market risk to them, which means that the risk you end up bearing as equity investors becomes a little less, right? Because you've got some risk sharing going on. So the second approach will actually give you a lower levered beta for a company than the first approach, but it does require additional information. You have to estimate a beta for debt. Again, I'll make a confession. I almost never use this extended approach for a company because if there's so much debt that its debt is junk bonds, then we're in big trouble using any of these equations anyway. So we're messing with the equation. So again, if you really, I put this equation out because again, there are people who push back saying, why aren't you being a purist? Why aren't you allowing for a beta of debt? Again, if that person is that insistent having a beta of debt, let him do the job of estimating the beta of debt. So I know how to adjust it. I just don't have a beta of debt. You estimate it and give it to me, and then we can make the adjustment. Because mechanically, once you have a beta of debt, adjusting for it becomes fairly simple. So start with the business. Adjust for operating leverage if you can, but it's going to be tough. Adjust for financial leverage, and you can use either approach. I'm really not a purist when it comes to that. Adjust for financial leverage, and you have a bottom-up beta for the company. So let's set the process up. You have a company. You want me to estimate your beta. I come to you with a question. What business or businesses are you in? And you tell me. I'm in steel, chemicals, and technology. Strange company, but it's not my company. You built it. So I trust you. So I'll be back. I go back to my office. I find as many publicly traded steel companies as I can, as many publicly traded chemical companies as I can, and as many publicly traded technology companies as I can. Why publicly traded? Because what can I look up for each of them then? A regression beta for each of them. So I have 100 steel, 100 chemical, and 100 technology. I look up their regression betas. Then I average them out. I get an average regression beta for a steel company, an average regression beta for a chemical company, an average regression beta for a technology company. Then because those are regression betas, they are levered betas. They reflect the debt-to-equity ratio these companies had over the period of the regression. So here's what I do. I compute the average debt-to-equity ratio for steel, chemical, and technology companies, and I unlever the beta. Sounds fancy, but I'm taking out the effect of debt from each of the betas. For those of you who remember your corporate finance class, there's one other adjustment you might need to make, which is if these companies have a lot of cash, you want to clean up for that cash. You want to come up with a pure play beta for being in steel, chemicals, and technology. Yes?
So when you fund publicly traded firms mm-hmm. in each of the businesses,
yep.
you want the firms you find to only be in that business?
That's actually an excellent point. Do you see Chris's point, which is I went looking for 100 steel companies, right? If I'll tell you the nice answer, and then we'll have to deal with the pragmatic consequences. It'd be nice if they were all entirely in steel or in chemicals, but it's almost never going to happen, right? So here's my fallback. If you have enough companies in your sample, the larger your sample, the sloppier you can get about how you define comparable. You see why? Because let's say they're only 70% steel, 30% something else. As long as that something else is different things, in some of those companies, that something else is going to be riskier than steel. In some of the companies, it's going to be safer than steel. So you're hoping that the 30% that's not steel gets averaged out. Will that happen with 9 companies? Probably not. With 100 companies, it probably will. So my rule of thumb is if it's predominantly in steel, 70-75% in steel, then I'm going to use it as a steel company and hope and pray that the rest gets averaged out. If all of them have a financing arm, then you know it's not going to average out. Then you have to be a little more explicit because then every steel company is, it's like doing simultaneous equations, part steel, part financial services. It's a nightmare, to be quite honest, but they might have no choice. Okay? Yes, Ashton.
I've seen it done where people will eliminate sort of outliers. So when they put together 100...
You know what, you know the problem with eliminating outliers is it's essentially you take the top and the bottom. It's very difficult to know when to stop because you know when you'll stop? It's when your average beta becomes very close to what you hope to see as your beta. So often when people start pruning samples, it's because they have a point of view about the beta. I think this company should have a high beta, so let me take all the low beta outliers. Because the word outlier already tells you that there is something you view as a norm. So if you have a beta of 4,000, that's an obvious outlier. If you have a beta of minus 500, obvious outlier. But is a beta of 0.2 an outlier? Well, that's very, very difficult to make a judgment on. So I try not to mess with the data. Yeah. Because I've found that when I start messing with the data, my biases start to kind of kick their way in. And that's something I think that it's so easy to become delusional in this process, saying, I'm just being objective, I'm just taking the top two and the bottom two out, but they might not have the same effect. So I try not to mess with it. The larger the sample, okay. One way to kind of deal with the outliers that I've discovered is rather than use simple averages, what's the alternative? The outliers push the simple averages all over the place, but stay with medians. It'll make your life a lot simpler. It'll give you a much better sense of control over the process. So that's, you now have a pure play beta for the three business. I come back to you and say, tell me how much value you get from each business. And your first reaction is going to be, I don't know how much value I get, but I can tell you how much revenues I get. So, okay, good. He says 60% from steel, 25% from chemicals, 15% from technology. I take a weighted average of my three pure play betas. I now have a pure play beta for your company. Then I bring in the financial leverage in your company. And I ask you, what's your debt to equity? And you and I'm completely flexible. You can give me your current market debt to equity. You can give me a target. You can give me what you hope to have. I can put in whatever debt to equity ratio I have, I want in that process and give you a levered beta. Now, why am I doing all of this? Because I don't like regression betas, right? But where do I get the 100 steel company betas? I got them from regressions. The only saving is I'm replacing one regression beta with an average of 100. That's the law of large numbers. And that is the biggest sales pitch I will make for bottom-up betas. That average beta you get is going to be far more precise, especially with large samples, than any individual regression beta. It sounds like a lot of work, but you're going to see in a few minutes that it really isn't. That once you've done that groundwork, which I do once a year, it serves me for the rest of the year because all I need are betas by businesses, the pure play betas, and the rest come out of those betas. So the biggest sales pitch you can make for bottom-up betas is they're going to be far more precise than a single regression beta. Now the reaction that a lot of analysts will have is, but it doesn't reflect the company. No, that's exactly the point. A beta is not supposed to reflect the company. It's supposed to reflect your exposure to macroeconomic risk. So you have a badly managed company, you know where it's going to show up? In your margins and your cash flows. You have a really well-managed company, it's going to... The beta is not the vehicle that you can use to adjust for all those things that worry you or please you about a company. Because once you start messing with the beta, you're going to start double counting or triple counting things you shouldn't be counting in. So biggest pitch is that it gives you a more precise number. Yes?
So if, say, a company's in steel, chemicals, mm-hmm. and...
Technology.
Technology, right? And so if it's diversified, inherently it should have a lower beta...
No, wait, depends on which direction you're coming from, right? It'll have a beta. Complete the story. As you get diversified, betas don't get lower. They move towards
one,
right? So if you start with a low beta and you diversify, your beta is going to move up towards one. So if you're a mining company, you start diversifying, you're going to move up towards one. If you're a technology company and you start entering other businesses, it's going to move down towards one. But you need to be diversified GE style before that happens, right? So if you're in technology and advertising, or retailing and advertising, you're diversified, but if you're diversifying across a subset of sectors which are all risky, your beta is not going to go towards one. It's going to go towards a weighted average beta of those sectors, right? It's only when you get a conglomerate, which is in 20, 25, 30 businesses, a United Technology, a GE, a Siemens, that you're going to see betas converge on one. Okay? Second big advantage of bottom-up betas is if you entered the technology business yesterday, I can reflect that in my beta. If you plan to divest yourself of the technology business tomorrow, not a big deal. I can reflect that in your beta. Is Yahoo's beta this week different than it was last week? Significantly. Why? What changed? Well, the minute Alibaba went public, they were forced to liquidate about a third of their holding, which means $8 billion worth of Alibaba equity is now $8 billion in cash. You don't need to be the extended financial analyst to know which direction the beta is moving, right? You've replaced the beta for Alibaba with the beta for cash, which is zero. So you can see companies' betas can shift fairly dramatically. You know what could change tomorrow? Is Marissa Mayer takes the ill advice that she's getting about what she should do with the beta, or with all this cash, and buy another company. Because tomorrow, who knows what she could buy? A social media company, maybe Snapchat? There goes your beta up again. Betas are on the move, just like cost of debt, cost of equity, cost of capital. Everything's on the move. Get used to it. Things won't stay still in this process. Okay? And finally, this is a process we can use to get a beta for a private business, a division. You can value Snapchat, even though it's not publicly traded, with the bottom-up beta approach. So you know from, if you're in my corporate finance class, how much I push this bottom-up beta approach. And I've tried to give you my best pitch. I'll extend that pitch later today. I'll send you a little, you know, little link of, you know, little webcast I did on a pitch for bottom-up betas. Watch it if you're still not convinced. If you are, then ignore it, because I'll be preaching to the converted. But bottom-up betas seem to me a much more logical way of thinking about betas. So let me use a few companies to kind of illustrate this process, because there are practical challenges in using this approach. Here's the first company I want to use, Vale. Vale is a mining company that is incorporated in Brazil. It is the largest iron ore mining company in the world by far. In fact, its history was it was a government-owned iron ore mining company, and then it was privatized, and now it's one of the, it's I think the third largest mining company in the world. So here's how Vale breaks its businesses down. First up, you're saying, where do I get the business breakdown? Where's the logical place to start looking for to find this? Start reading the annual report in the 10K. They might be lying, but at least there's some structured lying going on, and you can use that structure to get a sense of what the business. So they break themselves down into four businesses: metals and mining, which is everything but iron ore, because they do other stuff they've entered into, iron ore, fertilizers, and logistics. Here are my comparable firms. Notice that I'm using global for all four, because Vale is really a global company. Its iron ore mines are all over the world. So global firms in metals and mining, global firms in iron ore, global specialty chemical, global transportation firms. There's my sample size. See where the law of large numbers is really, really helping me? 693 specialty chemical companies. If anybody tells you they cannot find comparable firms, your reaction should be there are 41,000 publicly traded companies in the world. How can you not find comparable firms? It's impossible. Unless you're defining your business so narrowly that you will never find a comparable firm. Last week I got an email from somebody saying he was valuing a scallop fishing company. And could I give him a list of publicly traded scallop fishing companies? And I said, get your head out of the sand and think about what scallops are used for. They're used as food, and people eat them just like they eat other seafood. And it's a food processing company. It's not like scallops have their own macroeconomic environment with the demand and supply line driven by scallop demanders and scallop suppliers. I'm sure there's a substitution effect in place where if you go in and scallops are trading at $150 a scallop, so I'll take sea bass instead of shrimp or whatever your closest substitute is. Just don't get your business so narrow that you run into this brick wall of I can't find comparable companies. So there's my sample size. There's the unlevered beta, the pure play beta. And essentially I've done the dirty work of getting the regression beta, cleaning them up, pure play betas. There are the revenues that Vale used for, reported for each of the four businesses. Let me pause there. If I'm in a hurry, I have the betas, I have the revenues, I can use the revenues to weight the four businesses, right? But when I do that, I'm effectively telling you that a dollar in revenue in the iron ore business is worth the same as a dollar in revenue in the logistics business, the metals and mining business, and the chemical business, right? Is that true? I have no idea. So I checked, and here's how I checked. See these publicly traded companies from which I got the betas? I estimated two other numbers for each of those companies. I estimated an enterprise value, which is what? Market value of equity. It's supposed to be market value of debt, but 693 companies. I'm not messing with market value of debt, so I added the book value of debt minus cash. So that's the market's value of these companies. And I divided by the revenues at each of these companies. So I'm getting a multiple of revenues that the market is attaching to each of the companies. So the way to read this is a typical metal and mining company, the market is taking a dollar in revenues and attaching $1.97 in value to it. Is it right? That's not my judgment. I'm not valuing these companies right now. I'm just getting a beta for the company. So I multiply the revenues that Vale gets from metals and mining by 1.97. I get an estimated value for the business. I do this again for the iron ore business. I take the revenues, multiply by, come up with the value for the iron ore business. And you can see the enterprise values that I get are just the revenues times this EV to sales ratio, an attempt to estimate the value of each of the four businesses. Now, do I have to use revenues? I don't have to. I could have used EBITDA. I could have used EBIT. I could have used book value. But it's the same reason I liked revenues for coming up with equity risk premiums. The property they have is that they can never be negative, which means I will always get a value for a business. Whereas if I use any other number, there is a possibility that I could end up with a problem in estimating value. So it's a very simplistic ploy, but it's a ploy that allows me to come up with the value of the businesses and the weights. Incidentally, I mentioned, I think, in the first class that there is this approach to valuation that some people push, which is sum of the parts valuation. Sounds fancy, right? It's actually a back-of-the-envelope approach to valuation. I've just done a sum-of-the-parts valuation of Vale. You know what the sum-of-the-parts value is? It's this number right here. It's because I value the parts. I'm going to compare that to the market price. It's very simplistic because I just took a multiple and applied it to revenues. But that's all that most people who do sum-of-the-parts valuation are often doing, is estimating a value for each division based on the revenues or EBITDA of that division and some multiple at which companies trade at in that business to come up with the value for the business. So there are my weights. The only condition you've got to make sure is the weights add up to 100%. Otherwise, everything else is screwed. Right? So make sure that happens. You get a beta for the company, a weighted average beta of 0.844. That is my unlevered beta for Vale as a company. I put the debt to equity ratio at 55% for all four businesses. This is a struggle we had in the corporate finance class, right? Which is we'd like to get a debt to equity ratio for each business, but Vale doesn't borrow separately in each business. It wasn't worth the effort of breaking it down because they're all pretty capital intensive businesses. So I applied the same debt to equity ratio, came up with a levered beta and a cost of equity by business. So the cost of equity I will use for Vale in my valuation, and we'll see this valuation in a few sessions, is 11.23%. It's coming from a bottom-up beta. You think, why did I estimate a cost of equity for each of the four businesses? What if tomorrow Vale said it plans to spin off or sell off its logistics business? It came to you and said, can you value the business? The cost of equity I would use to value the logistics business is 10.29%. You have the tools now to value pieces of businesses and see what's left of the company after the divestiture or acquisition. Any questions on the process here? Let's take a simpler example. For valuation way back, about 10 years ago, and I valued Embraer. Global aerospace company, single business. Obviously, if you stay with aerospace companies in Brazil or emerging markets, there aren't too many, so I went global. The unlevered beta for global aerospace companies is 0.95. I applied the debt to equity ratio for Embraer to come up with the levered beta 1.07. And that's basically what I used in the valuation of Embraer. But in both Vale and Embraer, I am using global betas to estimate the beta for a company. And I'm doing it because it gives me a large sample. That's a convenient factor. But be prepared for some people to challenge, saying it's a Brazilian company. Shouldn't I be comparing you to other Brazilian companies or emerging market companies? The answer, of course, is that if you're an aerospace company, you're competing against Boeing and Airbus in a global market. I'll tell you the one caveat with using global numbers, where I tend to use, rather than global, I tend to stay with emerging markets. What do we say drives the beta of a company? It's how discretionary your product or service is, right? So let's divide the world into developed and emerging markets. Are there products and services that we think of as non-discretionary in developed markets that could be discretionary in emerging markets? Of course there are, right? You might think of phone service as non-discretionary in the US, but if you're in a growing market, it could be discretionary. What I'm trying to say is there are some businesses where if you're an emerging market telecom company, for instance, I could make the argument that your beta as a company should be higher than if you're a developed market telecom company. So that's one of the few exceptions to the rule of going global, is there I would stay with just, not with that country, but with emerging market, because I still need the large sample. So if you go to my website, you'll actually see the unlevered beta for the US, you'll see it for Europe, you'll see it for Japan, then you'll see it for global, which is all the companies everywhere. And then you'll see a beta for emerging markets. You'll actually see five betas for every business. And essentially, the reason I have all five is when I do evaluation, I have to make a judgment call. With U.S. companies, I actually trust those U.S. betas more because I know the index well. It's more a sense of I have a history with those betas. I know what those betas have looked like over time. So if I can get 35 U.S. companies, I'll just stick with that. Why go looking for trouble? But if I have to reach, I have to make that judgment as to whether I want global or emerging markets as my sample to use to come up with the beta for the company. Any questions on the process? Yes.
Let's say you have 10 companies in the same business, like categorized as media.
Right.
The business models are fundamentally different.
Tell me how they're affecting one of the... So basically, if you're telling me different business models, I'm going to trace it into one of those three. Yeah.
That was going to be my question, actually. So if, let's say you have in cable.
Right. Premium cable, kind of average cable.
So you have pay TV driven channels.
Right.
And then you have others that are more active. The risk profile would be very different, but they would show up as comps to each other in pretty much any kind of category.
There are 188 cable companies. So if you want to slice it down, so you're saying the entire sector is only 10 and they're all different, can you average out? Is that what you're
saying? Yeah, I mean, I was just saying,
it's first, let's take the word accurate out of the game. You're going to get a rough sense no matter how you slice the data. So, and remember, the consequences of getting a beta 1.1 instead of 1.22 on your valuation are almost nothing. So that's the first. So first thing to remember is that it's not getting the beta to the second decimal point. It's getting within shouting distance of the true beta. So I've lowered my ambitions. What I clearly don't want to do is take, if I have a retail sector where there's only one luxury retailer, to take a retail average and apply it to the luxury retailer, okay? Which is a scenario where I'm taking a business model that leads me to have a more discretionary product. This evening, I'm supposed to talk to the L'Oreal management, right? It's a luxury. So I looked at cosmetics companies, and I looked at their betas, but there is an argument to be made that those betas might underestimate the beta for a luxury. So one argument is maybe you should stray from the sector there. Go for other premium products. In other words, the question you're asking is, what are the other products or services that luxury, that discretionary dollar compete with? And maybe it'll be that NFL package is competing with, going to a luxury retailer. So maybe you'll go across those luxury businesses to come up with your beta. But you don't have to be sector focused there.
Simply, I understand the,
right? Right.
But when you know that a business is very distinct, is it fair to make an adjustment on top of that average that you get?
As long as you get a large enough sample with it, you're okay. So if you give me a choice of three companies where you made the adjustment and ended up with a sample of 3 versus 80, I'll go with the 80. But if you make the adjustment and end up with 22, I'm okay with it. But that requires, again, that you start with a big number and prune it down. But you need, I'll give you a rough sense of how the sample size shows up in your standard error. If you have only 4 companies in your sample, your standard error is going to be half what it was in a regression beta. If you have 9 companies in your sample, it's going to be 1/3. If you have 25, it's going to be 1/5. If you're wondering what that rule is, you can see it, right? 4, take the square root of the number of companies in your sample. That gives you, roughly speaking, how much improvement you get. So 4 is better than 1, 9 is better than 4, 16 is better than 9, 25 is better than 19. But by the time you get to 25, you're already... No, your standard error is already half what it was with the regression beta. You can get from 25 to 100, great, but I'm not going to stretch to do that if I don't have to. Okay. Now, one other issue, the debt-to-equity ratio here that you see here is a gross debt-to-equity ratio. You know what I mean by gross debt? It's total debt divided by market equity. And the reason I say that is in much of Europe and Latin America, there is this practice in analysis and research of using net debt ratios, where you net cash out against debt. And often this is a source of big confusion, which is, you know, what if I want to use net debt ratios? Can we use the same approach? So let me show you what the numbers will look like for Embraer if I decide to use net debt ratios instead of gross debt ratios. With a gross debt to equity ratio of 18.95%, the levered beta I got was 1.07. And that's the typical approach I use. The net debt to equity ratio for Embraer is minus 3.32%. First rule to remember when you use net debt to equity ratios is you can end up with a negative number. Don't try to be clever by flooring it at zero, saying I can't use a debt. A net debt to equity can be negative. Run with it. Plug it into the levered beta equation, and if you plug in a negative debt to equity, your levered beta is actually going to be lower than your unlevered beta. This seems like a great thing, right? That's going to make your cost of equity lower. You say, let's use net debt ratios all the time. But where does the cost of equity go? It goes into a cost of capital equation. And in that cost of capital, you know what your debt ratio is going to look like for Embraer? It's going to be a negative number, which means when I do the cost of capital for Embraer, whatever one hand gave you by giving you a lower beta and a lower cost of equity, the other hand will take away. The number you should be thinking about is the end cost of capital. So my advice to you is if you want to use net debt ratios, fine. Just stay with them all the way through. What gets people into trouble are two things. One is selective pruning of the net debt ratio. When it goes below zero, you use zero. Don't do that. Just go with the negative number. The second is going back and forth between gross and net numbers. So there's nothing problematic or difficult about working with net debt ratios as long as you use them all the way through. Any questions? Yes?
You're using 1 minus the tax rate.
Yeah.
Get a tax shield.
You're not wrong. The interest expense does, but it gets it every year.
Yes.
It's a perpetuity.
The interest expense does.
But back up here. So you get one minus, so the tax rate times the interest expense is the saving each year, right?
Yeah.
Let's say you get that every year forever. What's the present value of a perpetuity? It'll be T times I divided by the discount rate that applies to that perpetuity, which in this case is a debt perpetuity, and that discount rate is going to be the I's. So basically, the I's will cancel out. So basically, in the numerator will be a tax rate times the interest rate times the dollar debt divided by the interest rate. Basically, that's a perpetuity formula. So it's a shortcut. We do it all the time. It's sloppy because it makes that perpetuity assumption. But that's what makes the interest rate drop out of the process, even though it's only the present value of getting a tax savings on your interest expense forever is really the tax rate times the dollar debt. It makes your life infinitely simple. It does come with that cost of that assumption, but that's why you see the tax rate times the debt show up as the present value of tax benefits forever. Okay? Any other questions? Yes?
Just going back, sorry, for a second, yep, to that scallop example that you gave out. So
yes.
With that sort of in mind,
yep,
you know, it's a very niche business, but if you were able to...
Is that a word, niche? Maybe it should be a word. Okay.
Is it worth including those, or is
absolutely
that too arbitrarily volatile?
No, I think in a sense, it's start narrow, right? So if you find 100 scallop fishing companies in the world, go with it. But if you're, so my choice is to start narrow, because obviously there might be some fixed cost with scallops I don't even know about. Maybe they have to sit on the scallops for 6 hours before they kind of become what they are, or, you know. So if I can, I start narrow. And that's the nice thing about using something like S&P Capital IQ, is you can go with a very narrow sample of just your country, just the subsector of the subsector first, and it'll show you how many companies come through, right? It says 7 companies came through. You say, that's not enough. Let me relax 1. So it allows you to kind of play with your criteria until you get enough of a sample. So there's nothing wrong with starting small and including more companies as you go along, rather than starting really large if you don't have to.
But what I was really trying, yeah, to sort of get a sense of is even with these sort of like things like penny stocks or OTC, any of that, you think that data is worthwhile and not going to sort of create unnecessary noise by going that?
I think that you might restrict stocks so you don't trust the trading, because a beta comes from a regression page, so you want enough trading in there. So putting in a trading constraint is really to capture the noise of, because at the limit, if you have zero trading in a stock, its beta is going to go to a zero, right? So you want at least, so you might put some minimal trading constraints on it, so you don't want to bring in really, really small companies that never trade into the sample. So that's a perfectly legitimate constraint to put in because it's a regression beta and you want the regression beta to reflect the true macroeconomic risk of the company. And that's one reason why I like U.S. betas, is I know the trading volume patterns across U.S. stocks. Whereas if you gave me the betas for African companies, there's a beta reported by S&P Capital IQ, but I don't even know what it means. How often do Ghanaian stocks trade or Ivory Coast stocks? I have no idea. Maybe they trade a lot and I just don't know it. But that's, I think, the constraint with going to really small emerging markets. The betas might mean very little. Any other questions? Now, one final point about global betas is when you use these global samples, in a perfect world, you'd like the betas all to be estimated against a common index, right? Because if I have all the U.S. company betas against an S&P 500, all the Indonesian companies against a Jakarta stock, I mean, so you have this mix. In a perfect world, you'd actually like to estimate the betas again. But unfortunately, when you use a service like Capital IQ, you're kind of stuck with whatever beta they've estimated. Unless you want to redo every beta on a Bloomberg terminal, it's really tough to get a call. So you know what my fallback on that is? The law of large numbers. Because as long as the indices are screwed up, but they're screwed up randomly. In other words, some of the betas are overestimated, some are underestimated. The larger my sample, the sloppier I can get. So now let's bring it all together in the cost of equity. Everything in your cost of equity has a place. So let's start with the risk-free rate. The risk-free rate is a function of what currency you've decided to do the analysis, not where the company's incorporated. So you tell me what currency you've chosen. The risk-free rate should be in that currency. Less work in some currencies than others. The equity risk premium is where I'm going to put in your exposure geographically. So if you're an emerging market company or a company with emerging market exposure, the equity risk premium is where it shows. The beta reflects your business exposure. So risk-free rate for currency, beta for business mix, equity risk premium for country risk exposure. Don't let them spill over into other places. So now that we have the cost of equity, let's talk a little bit about the cost of debt. The cost of debt is the rate at which you can borrow money long-term today. Let's start easy and then move more difficult. If you have a company that has publicly traded bonds and those bonds are liquid, they're traded a lot, and don't have any special features throwing off the rate, you can actually take a long-term bond issued by that company, take the yield to maturity in the bond, and use that as your cost of debt. I'll also tell you that I almost never use this approach because look at all the conditions you need. The company needs to have bonds outstanding. That already removes 90% of the companies in the sample, right? Second, those bonds have to be liquid and traded. A lot of companies have bonds outstanding, but they never trade. They disappear into somebody's portfolio, and the price you see is a matrix price. Third, you can't have any special features because if you give me the rate on a convertible bond, it's kind of meaningless. So by the time I get through those choices, it's going to be very difficult to find a bond that captures the true cost of debt. But if you can, that's the easiest choice. But if you have bonds outstanding, even if they're not liquid and traded, you're probably also going to have a bond rating, right? Do you have to have a bond rating to have bonds traded? No, it's actually not required. The only problem is if you refuse to get rated and you then issue bonds, people are going to say, why are you refusing to get rated? And you can go on a rant about S&P and Moody's not being fair to you, but it's not going to help you. So if you have bonds outstanding, you probably have a rating, which means I can use the rating to come up with a cost debt. Note a caution. Ratings agencies often attach two ratings, one for the company overall and one for the individual bond. Which one do you want to use for your cost of debt? You want to use the one for the company because the one for the individual bond will reflect how safe that specific bond is. Remember, you can be a risky company that issues a really safe bond. So you want to make sure you get the rating for the company and back. The problem, though, is what if you have a company without bonds and without ratings, which is going to be the case for 90% of all companies out there, including many companies in the U.S. There, I'm going to go through a process, which, again, I'm going to draw on what I did in corporate finance, which is I'm going to estimate a rating for the company using a very simple ratio analysis. And the ratio I'm going to base my rating on is the interest coverage ratio. Operating income divided by interest expense. So as an example, if I took Embraer, I used the average operating income over 3 years. And incidentally, you get full freedom to determine what you want to use in this operating income So you can use last year's number, a five-year number, a three-year number. I used a three-year average. Divide by the interest expense gives me an interest coverage ratio in 2003 of 3.56. You should be able to compute that for any company, small or large, private or public, though you might get a negative number, right? If you have a money-losing company. Let's talk about those later because that's going to be an entirely different set of problems to deal with. But if you have a money-making company, you can get an interest coverage ratio. Your task then becomes to convert that interest coverage ratio into a rating. I'm going to call it a synthetic rating to reflect the fact that I'm making up the rating based on one ratio. And the lookup table I use is one you should begin that you've seen before, where if you tell me the interest coverage ratio for your company, I'll tell you what rating goes for that company. Notice there are two columns here, one for small companies, one for small companies and one for large. So if you were a large market cap company, I'd use this first column. If you're a small market cap company, I'd use the second column. For Embraer, I actually use the second column because its interest coverage ratio 3.56, and in 2003 it was a smaller, riskier company. The rating I would attach to Embraer would be BB. It's a very simple process. Take the interest coverage ratio, look up the rating, and then look up the default spread that goes with that rating. And you can see that default spread can shift even between 2003 and 2004. The number will be different. I'll give you a link that you can use to get the updated numbers. But that is the process for estimating the default spread. And once you have the default spread, the rest is done. Okay. One final point about cost of debt. You've got a risk-free rate plus a default spread for the company. But if you're in a risky country, there might be a second burden that you have to carry as a company, which is the risk of the country. It's unfair. But if you're a Greek company or an Argentine company, you walk into a bank and say, I'm a Greek company, I want to borrow money. The banker says 35% plus. You say, I haven't shown you my financials. He says, it doesn't matter, you're a Greek company. It's not fair, but that's the nature of being an emerging market company. Which effectively means when I want to compute the cost of debt for an emerging market company, I have to add two default spreads, one for the company and one for the country. But here's the potential problem. When I do that, I'm assuming that every Argentine company carries Argentine country default risk, right? In fact, the ratings agencies used to make this explicit. They had what was called a sovereign rating ceiling. What that effectively meant, that if you were a company in a country with a BB rating, the highest rating you could aspire to get as a company was BB. What changed that was markets started ignoring that rating ceiling. And if you're Petrobras, when Brazil was very risky 10 years ago, Petrobras was able to borrow money at a rate lower than the Brazilian government was. So that rating ceiling has been relaxed, but it's still a factor. So here's how I'm going to get a cost of debt for Embraer. I took the risk-free rate in U.S. dollars. Why? Because I did my valuation in U.S. dollars. I added the default spread for Embraer as a company, and I added a portion of Brazil's country default spread. It's like a lambda, but it attached the cost of debt. So where do you come up with the two-thirds? I actually found 11 Brazilian global companies at that time that had bonds outstanding. And I looked at the spreads on their bonds relative to the spread for Brazil as a country. And at least in 2004, those 10 or 11 large Brazilian companies had default spreads that were actually lower than the default spreads for the Brazilian government because for whatever reason, the market viewed them as safer than the Brazilian government was. So my cost of debt in dollar terms for Embraer would be 9.29%, risk-free rate plus company default spread plus country default spread. If you find this too messy, this two-thirds part, just take it out. Just add the entire country default spread, move on. It's not worth the effort of kind of finessing that number. But remember that with emerging markets, you will get that second component. Now, the ratings table that I showed you, let me give you a little bit of history of how I developed it. I actually took every rated company in the U.S., and I put a big Excel spreadsheet together of the rating in the first column and the interest coverage ratio for the company in the second column. Then I did a pivot table around the rating. Have you ever done pivot tables in Excel? Basically, it consolidates all AAA, AA to see what the interest coverage ratios look like for AAA, AA, single A. So I had that table. And then I played with the table. And I really mean played because I wanted to create these lookup ranges where you couldn't overlap. So there's an element of subjective judgment here, but it was built off U.S. rated companies. In a couple of weeks, I'm supposed to be in Mexico City, and I'm going to be valuing Arca, the company that I put up. So that's a company I'm going to be evaluating. I could try to create a lookup table based on Mexican-rated companies, but what's the problem I'm going to run into? You need a lot of companies to create a lookup table. So if there are only 60 companies, I'm not going to get enough of it. So what I'm confessing here is I often will take the U.S. table that I've created and transport it to markets where there are no rated companies, markets like Croatia or Poland or Guatemala. You say, will this work still? You've got to hope and pray it does, but I'll give you my conditions under which I feel comfortable doing this and conditions under which I might have to adapt. If the risk-free rate in the currency that I'm doing the valuation is pretty close to U.S. dollar risk-free rate, which is either going to be the case if I'm doing everything in U.S. dollars or the local currency risk-free rate is 2 or 3%, then I feel okay using these default spreads because they're built off a 2.5% risk-free rate. But if I'm valuing companies in Brazil and I'm doing things in nominal reais, so the risk-free rate is 10 or 11%, I've got to be a lot more careful about adding a U.S. dollar-based default spread to it. So the markets where it travels the best are markets where the risk-free rates are roughly the same, the currencies that I'm looking at. The markets where it does the worst are the markets where you have these high risk-free rates, 10, 12, 15% rates. I'll come back and talk about what to do with those countries, but that's the one thing to remember. So a little sense of default spreads. Remember last session I showed you the implied equity risk premium through 2008, that last 14 weeks, how it kind of went from 4.37 to 8 to 6.43, the crisis. I took default spreads on bonds, and I also tracked it through 2008. Again, to kind of dispel the notion that somehow if your rating stays the same as a company, your cost of debt is not changing. So let's say you took a BBB rated company. On January 1st, 2008, if you were a BBB rated company, your default spread was about 2%. Let's say you stayed BBB rated all the way through 2008. So nothing's changed about you as a company, right? But by the time you get to the end of 2008, look at what the default spread was on a BBB rated bond. It was 5.75%. So just as equity risk premiums change over time, default spreads can change over time, especially during crises. Of course, it went back down and went back up again, which means if you're valuing a company today, you'd like to know what the default spreads look like as of right now. Now, this table that I'm going to show you next doesn't quite answer the question, but the source from which I got this table can be used to answer the question. It's a link I gave you in my corporate finance class. It's called bondsonline.com. The good news is they have updated default spreads by ratings class, by maturity. So it looks very much like this table. The bad news is they charge, I think, $49 for a snapshot. But here's the thing. I'm not a fixed income trader. I don't need snapshots six times a day. I go in and I take four snapshots, one in March, one in June, one in September, one in December. And I use those default spreads for the 3 months following. Of course, if there's a market crisis in the middle, I might revisit and pay another $49. But it's a small enough price to pay given that the alternative is I go look up 50 bonds in each ratings class and average out there. It's a great source. So I hope it stays online. I hope they don't raise the price to $4.99. There's a tipping point here, and I'm pretty close to that tipping point, at which point I will use 2013 spreads for the rest of eternity if need be. Yeah? Or call you up if you're at Goldman and say, can you look up some default spreads and just give them to me. But it's my point is it's not difficult getting default spreads anymore. The data is there. Just use the most updated numbers you can. This morning, actually, is interesting. I got this slide in here because this morning I got an email from a Brazilian, must be an equity research analyst who started 2 or 3 years ago, and he was valuing a Brazilian company that had subsidized debt. So he's asked me for some advice, and I think you have the tools to be able to answer him. And I'll use Embraer to kind of illustrate the point. Embraer used to be a government-owned company. It still has significant government resources behind it. And one of the things that Embraer is able to do is borrow money from the government at a subsidized rate. What is the definition of subsidized rate? Basically, this is a rate you would not be able to borrow at in the public marketplace. It's lower than a fair rate. So in this case, let's assume that the government is willing to lend to Embraer at 6% instead of 9.29%. Your job is to compute the value of Embraer today. So here's my question. When I do my cost to capital for Embraer, I know the 9.29%, which I got into by getting a rating and adding default spreads, I got to that there. But I know that they're borrowing money at 6%. Can I use my 6% as my pre-tax cost of debt in my cost of capital? First, look with the mechanics. If I put in a 6% pre-tax cost of debt, it'll push my cost of capital down. It'll push my value higher. But that's reasonable, right? Because if you get a subsidy, that's a value increment. But what's the danger? Okay. Two things, right? One, governments never give anything away for free. There's always another shoe waiting to drop. In return for giving you the subsidy, they're probably going to mess with you somewhere else. Like when you sell aircraft to somebody, they might step in and say, why don't you sell it at a 20% discount? So it's kind of a mixed blessing, right? Which means if you want to bring in that subsidy effect, you've got to bring in the whole effect, which is what's the cost you're paying? Is there a price control? Something you're giving up. The second is, as you pointed out, by putting it into the cost of capital, I make it permanent. And we know governments can't permanently subsidize businesses. So is there a way I can bring this into my valuation without bringing it into my cost of debt? What's the actual explicit benefit of this subsidy? It's actually very simple. That I'm paying 6% on debt that I should have paid 9.29. So how much do I save each year? Take 3.29%. You can put an explicit appearance. I have a 10-year loan. 3.29% a year is what I save each year. Take the present value of the savings. You're done. Why are you messing with your cost of capital? It's an extra benefit. Do your conventional valuation with a 9.29% pre-tax cost of debt. Bring the subsidy in separately. In fact, I did this for an Indian company. It was a sugar producing company where in India with sugar you have all these they get a price support and other stuff. So they said, well, can we bring this? I said, let's do the valuation as if you have no government subsidy. Then let's look at the government effect separately. And what we did was we listed out all the good things that came with the government support and all the bad things. I valued all the good things separately and I put the bad things and I netted it out and said, maybe you guys should give up on this subsidy because it's actually lowering your value rather than increasing your value, because what the government is extracting in pain from you is far greater than what it's giving you as a subsidy. And it's something that companies might want to think of. It's part of the reason Tesla paid off. It used to have a subsidized loan from the U.S. government. It really wasn't worth it because it was exposing them to all kinds of criticism. It was this tiny amount. $300 million for a $30 billion company. They said, we don't want this headache. Yeah, you can have the loan back. So sometimes it's good to separate out government subsidy effects and figure out what it's creating in terms of value for you and what the costs are. So when you do costs of debt, remember that. It's a long-term cost of borrowing money today. Make sure you get that cost. Now let's talk about weights. The rule in corporate finance and valuation, every book is use market value weights. Anybody here doing the CFA exams? No? Nobody's doing the CFA? Okay, that's interesting. Because I give the keynote talk to the CFA people every year, and I beg them to let me write the exam once. Because the way the CFA exam is written, even if you don't take the CFA, it's an endurance test. And here's the way it works. They make you read 8,000 pages. And they ask you what was on page 3,277. It's a closed book exam because they need to fail about 70% of the people taking the exam to make the CFA more valuable. So I said, can you give me a chance to write the... I'll have only one question. It can be open book, open notes. And if they get the answer right, you should give them all three levels at one go. So you ready? I'm going to be the unofficial CFA grantor. In the next minute, those of you who can answer this question, get all three levels of a CFA, you have to put some brackets around it. It's like that boxing convention. You don't know whose championship you actually won. Okay? So here's my question. All the conventional wisdom is you have to use market value weights. Why? And I'll give you the choices. I'll even make it multiple choice. And you tell me which of these is the answer to why we use market value weights. Is it because the market is usually right? What's the problem with picking that? If you pick that as your answer, use that to justify using market value weights to get a cost of capital, then you value the company And you come up with a value different from the market price. You see the problem you created for yourself? You told me at the start you were doing this because the market's usually right. At the end of the process, you say, oh, by the way, in this particular company, with my valuation, I thought the market made a mistake. So that's not it. Because market values are easy to obtain. As opposed to what? Book values? There it is, shareholders' equity right there on the balance sheet. Total debt right there on the balance sheet. So they're both easy to obtain. Because book values of debt and equity are meaningless. My bias against accountants wants me to pick C. But they're not quite meaningless. They're dated, they're backward-looking. So in fact, D was the right answer. I think everyone would pick D. So add a CFA to your names right now, right? I'll give you the answer. And in fact, we're going to come back and talk about this. Every discounted cash flow valuation is actually an exercise in an acquisition valuation where you're buying the entire equity and the debt in the market today. So the proposition you're asking is, if I went out and bought this whole company in the market today, how much would it cost me? What's the answer to that? It's whatever the market price is. This has to be an acquisition on the sly. So nobody knows you're doing it. You're buying the whole. The market doesn't have to be right. It's a transaction price. It's what it'll cost you to buy the company. That's why we use market value weights. And that's why we're okay with that inconsistency of the weights I use for my cost of capital are not the numbers I think this company is actually worth, because what you and I think about the intrinsic value of Alibaba is irrelevant. You call your broker today and you say, look, I'm willing to pay intrinsic value of $66 per share. He's going to say, that's nice, and he's going to hang up the phone on you. It doesn't matter what you and I think intrinsic value is. The price is what you have to pay. So if I have to value Alibaba today, I have to use the market price to come up with the market value of equity and the debt ratio and the cost of capital, because that is the transaction cost I will face in buying the entire company. So there you have the answers to why we use market value weights. So the cost of capital, just to bring all these numbers together for Embraer, for the cost of equity, so this is a US dollar cost of capital. There's the risk-free rate, the bottom-up beta, the mature market premium, the lambda, remember that? That we estimated last week based on that regression against country risk. Cost of equity of 10.7%, cost of debt with the country risk again in it. The weights are market value weights, 37, 81, and 713, 84% equity, 16% debt, gives me a cost of capital of 9.97%. Incidentally, I converted the book value of debt, which was 1953, into a market value by using that bond pricing equation, by taking the coupon, the interest expense as my coupon, and the maturity of the debt as my life for the bond. So that's where we've been leading in all these numbers, and it gives us a cost of capital that reflects what I can value this company at today. Let's say you do this for your company, and you do everything in U.S. dollar terms till about 4 weeks from now when you decide, oh, my God, I should have done everything in pesos or reais. Don't freak out. There's a very quick process you can use to convert your U.S. dollar or euro cost of capital into any other currency. And to do this, here's all you need to do. Give me the expected inflation rate in reais and dollars. And we talked a little bit about this in the context of risk-free rates, right? Take the U.S. dollar cost of capital of 9.97%. Let's say the inflation rate in Brazil is 8%, the inflation rate in the U.S. is 2%. There's my real cost of capital. It's an incredibly convenient way of converting cost of equity or cost of capital in one currency to another, is to take the differential inflation between the two. You could have always done it from scratch by taking the risk-free rate in reais, but then you're making assumptions about default spreads, which are dollar spreads being added to a risk-free rate. So if you have really high inflation rates in your currency, my suggestion is you do everything in dollars till the last step, then apply the inflation differentials to get the cost of capital in that currency. Now, when you look at your company, you know, if you're lucky, you might find just debt and equity. If you're not, you're going to see some hybrids, convertible bonds, preferred stock. It's a pain in the neck. You'd like them to go away, but they won't. So I'll take the easy part of the hybrids. If you have convertible bonds, get rid of them. Break them down into their debt and equity components. The debt is actually the bond component. The conversion option is the equity component. So break them down. Put the equity into the equity. The debt into the debt goes away. Preferred stock, I wish we had a law that said no more preferred stock ever. Because you can't put it into debt, because preferred dividends are usually not tax deductible. You can't put into equity because it's really more debt than equity, at least in the U.S. So with preferred stock, if you have a significant amount of preferred stock, I'll curse you till my hair turns white, which it already is. Then add a third component to my cost of capital and move on. That's the only exception I have to the rule of two, only two components in my cost of capital. Final page, and then we'll end for the day. So if I gave you a convertible bond, say, how the heck do I break it down into debt and equity component? What did I say the two parts of a convertible bond were? Straight bond and equity option, right? The conversion option. Which one's going to be easy to value? Unless you're a freakishly finance-oriented person, the straight bond is going to be easier to value. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take the convertible bond with the coupon and the maturity and price it as a straight bond using the market interest rate. Value I get is $91.45 million. Then I take the difference between the market value of the convertible bond and that straight bond. The rest, because I never have to bring the option pricing model out of the closet, because I can value the straight bond and take the rest and put into equity. So that's the cost of capital for a company, the cost of equity, the cost of debt. So when you get a chance, review what we've talked about, because everything is in there that should go into a discount.
$30 years. Thank you.